Questions about anything we covered last class? We got a government. Called what? What's the first system of government that was created? What? No.
Constitution.
No.
Articles of Confederation.
The Articles of Confederation. All right. Now, they created this government based on their experiences they had throughout the war and their political opinions on the tyranny imposed upon them by Parliament and King George. So was this government that they created powerful? No, it was not. It was not. By design, it was meant to be weak. So in a confederation, the parts, which are the states, basically had more control over the central government. All it kind of was like a loose-knit alliance, kind of like the EU is today. But the problem was while it was new, while it was an inventive, while they did have some pluses, most of the minuses were significant, and these got exposed in the events as they began playing out in real time. You, sir. Name?
Nick.
You, ma'am.
Allison
and Nick. All right. So I don't know if you've had U.S. history that covers the post-colonial period, but we'll just say that life was not good. There were lots and lots and lots of problems that if you put it in comparison with really what we're dealing with today, it makes a lot of the stuff that we're dealing with almost small potatoes. So, for instance, there really was no national economy. The economy was a complete cluster because, by design, the states were countries. They had their own currencies. Each state had their own money. Each state made fiscal policy for their people, including laying in tariffs for interstate trade. I don't remember the exact amount, but Massachusetts had so high tariffs on Rhode Island that it was cheaper for people in Rhode Island to do business with Georgia, which of course involved putting stuff on ships and shipping it all the way down the Atlantic coast than it was to put it on a wagon and bring it across the border. The other problem, because each of the states were countries, they had their own debts. Many of them had borrowed money to pay for their militias fighting in the War of Independence. So there was no person in the middle that could kind of regulate all of this activity. Congress, under the Articles, had no authority to interfere with the economy. There also was no safety net. Businesses went belly up. Farms went belly up. People lost their jobs in a snap of a finger. To make matters worse, the Continental Congress did try making a national currency during the war, but by the end of the war, those continental dollars were worthless. Interesting little side note factoid, because I know weird shit. One of the first cases to get before the United States Supreme Court, once the Constitution was ratified, had to do with an issue that arose during the 1780s, where a guy wanted to basically pay a loan on his house with continental dollars, but the person who the money was owed to refused and foreclosed on the house. Well, in the end, the Supreme Court sided with the lender Because if the money's useless, how can you buy anything with it? So it was just a logistical nightmare. And on the debt, guess who the states borrowed from to fight the war?
France.
Countries like France. Do you think France was just going to forgive our debt? Now remember, France was, I guess you could call them a continental power, because they were big, obviously, in Europe, but they had a navy that was almost as strong as England's. They could have easily started attacking us like the British did.
So, like, Britain and France, they were, like, kind of, like, all throughout history, kind of always had each other's throats.
Absolutely.
So I feel like America was always, like, or I guess the United States was almost, like, an investment to, like, put, like, a gold in Britain's side.
Oh, yeah.
And France is like, okay, where's our money back?
Right.
Like, now, I guess.
Well, to put it contextually, England defeated France in what we call over here the French and Indian War.
Yes.
And we took all of Canada. Well, this was just a decade and a half, the War for Independence afterwards. Yeah, you're right. Don't you think France wanted to be like, well, fine, screw you.
Yeah.
We'll get you back. We'll cripple your economy. So yeah, it was definitely tit for tat. And if you recall, could Congress, under the Articles, demand that the states give money to the central government to pay the debts? No, they could not. All they could do is ask. They couldn't basically send them a bill and say, you must pay. So do you think any of the states who had their own debts were going to suddenly give more money to this national government?
Absolutely not.
No, 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 not at all, not at all. So, there was efforts to try to fix the problem. For instance, under the Articles, the Congress did appoint an officer that was called the Secretary of Finance. The first one to hold that position was Robert Morris, one of the big founding fathers. You don't need to remember his name. And he started proposing, well, maybe the Congress should start applying national taxes so the national government can raise revenue to pay its debts. He proposed a national tariff. He proposed land taxes. He proposed poll taxes and excise taxes, in particular on liquor. They were just basically saying, we got to do, if the states aren't going to give us money for the nation to pay its bills, we got to do something. But of course, how much does it take for that Congress under the Articles to actually pass any piece of legislation? Anyone have it in their notes? What was the ratio?
It was unanimous.
Well, that was major laws. So like amendment change. You're right. That was unanimous. 100% right on that. But like a regular law.
Wasn't it a two-thirds majority?
You needed a two-thirds majority. So again, I think we didn't even agree on Taco Tuesday. We couldn't even agree on tacos for dinner.
Damn it.
So do you think these delegates who are representing their states want to basically say, well, yeah, we'll vote for new taxes for the national government? No. To your point, no, not at all. Want nothing to do with it. So every single proposal to try to save the country, nope, nope, nope.
So is that why, like, America has $1 trillion of debt?
That's under the new government. We'll talk about that. One of the biggest problems that we have today is there's nothing in the Constitution, the second frame of government, that prevents the government to engage in what's called deficit spending. Meaning, they spend more than they take in. There were efforts all throughout the 90s and early 2000s to pass what was called a balanced budget amendment that would basically require Congress to only spend what it takes in.
Mm-hmm.
But it got rejected.
Of course it did.
Yep.
I have a question and then kind of like a follow-up.
Sure.
So like, was there like any form, I think you kind of already said it, like with like the like a lot of companies like going belly up and like rebranding and stuff. So I'm assuming there wasn't much of like an insurance, like no sort of.
There was insurance agencies, insurance. Actually, I think they were called insurance houses back then.
Okay.
But typically, what those were is used for like merchants. So if you owned a shipping company, you could go in and you could buy an insurance policy that would protect your ship in the case of it getting sunk at sea.
Okay.
But to my knowledge, there was no, there definitely was no health insurance. And I don't think there was like homeowner's insurance policy. I don't think any of that had been devised yet.
And like when's about the time to start?
Probably the 20th century, I would think.
Good. Interesting question. Interesting question.
When did what start?
Like just like insurance.
Oh, okay.
That came up in my family discussion the other day.
Now, not that this has anything to do with our class, but insurance, the idea of insurance actually goes all the way back to the Renaissance. And again, we just kind of borrowed it as our country was established.
Yeah.
All right, so
no economy, bankruptcies, no jobs, losing the farms, debt, bills that had to be paid.
Well, guess who also did not get paid?
People.
The guys who fought the damn war.
Yeah. All throughout the 1780s, the veterans, the men who defeated the British, all up and down the coast in every single state, were organizing themselves, or remaining organized, because they were militias, outraged that they were not getting their pay. Even though the Congress basically said, okay guys, war's over, go home, the units themselves refused to disband.
And there were some conspiracies that were of national significance, including what was known as the Newburgh Conspiracy, where the Virginia militia contemplated marching up to Philadelphia and seizing the Continental Congress and holding the Congress ransom until they got paid.
That's wild.
And if they did not get paid, they would topple the Congress, and they would select a king. Guess who the officers wanted to be the king? George Washington.
Oh, really?
That conspiracy was only derailed because a rat, I guess, went to Washington, told him what was going on. He traveled at raceneck speed to where they were meeting, walked in on them, which caused all the guys to be like, oh, it was described. They all just sat in awe. And he basically said under no circumstances would he endorse this. Under no circumstances would he support this. Because after all, didn't they just fight a war to get rid of the king? And at that time, he kind of emasculated all the men and they stood down.
But again, what if this close to this experiment just being derailed? And as if that was not bad enough,
we were a nation in a big world that had other powers.
So as we alluded to earlier, we had to deal with the fact that other nations wanted to see us fall, including countries that occupied territory geographically to our north, to our west, and our south. Remember, when this occurred, all we had was the 13 colonies on the coast, and you go inland up until the Mississippi. That's it. That's all we had. Canada was controlled by the British. Much of the Western Plain State west of Mississippi was controlled by Spain, as was Florida. These monarchies did not want to see this confederation succeed. The Brits, for example, did not pull out of the forts that were in Ohio, in upper state New York. They still had soldiers technically on U.S. territory. They controlled the fur trade. They stirred up the Indians. And they blocked any American ship that tried going through the Great Lakes, seizing them on the open waters, engaging what's called impressment. In Spain, Spain started moving soldiers up Florida and building fortifications on what was the Georgia-Florida line. And they were whipping up the Indian tribes to go in and start harassing American settlers. Yes?
I was just wondering, was there a name for that almost rebellion by the Virginia militia?
Yeah, it was called the Newburg Conspiracy. And then if that was not enough, no nation wanted to do trade with us. Because think about it, if they engaged in trade, that would basically be endorsing a group of people who no longer have kings. And at the time in Europe, everybody were under kings. So you can kind of make sense of the fact that they didn't want to inspire revolutions with their own country. Because coincidentally, what do you think happened in France few years later after our war was over? Yeah, they were inspired by us. So there were problems left and right. So again, if you ever think you're having a bad day, imagine living during this time. And to make matters worse, the Congress, the best way I can describe it, is feckless. They had no wherewithal, no motivation, no energy to fix the problems. They started acting like politicians. You know how like politicians, you know, are regarded kind of some of the slimiest people in the world because they're usually self-serving. Well, you read the letters in the papers of the day, and those ideas were being expressed back then. So the nation was on the verge of complete collapse. And by the way, there were stories in English newspapers, in French newspapers, in Spanish newspapers, basically saying that when the United States falls, that they'd basically just carve it up. You know, Spain would probably take all the way up to maybe North Carolina, South Carolina. England would get like New England and New York. And if the French want the middle states, go at it. You know, they were literally waiting for us to die. But the one thing we had going was there were men that saw the forest for the trees and realized that if they did not act and do something, the experiment would fail. As James Madison wrote in Federalist Number 10, and I quote, "Our governments are too unstable that the public good is disregarded in the conflicts of rival parties, and that measures are too often decided, not according to the rules of justice and the rights of the minor party, but by the superior forces of an interests and overbearing majority." Most of the people were sitting around being like, "Ooh, we can't do anything." But a few men rose up and said, "Yeah, you know what we need to do? Go back to the drawing board." To Madison and others, the only solution was to create a new government that had the ability to deal with all of the problems we just mentioned. Why? You just fought a war for independence. You ready to give up? Or are you going to roll up your sleeves and go to work and keep this experiment going?
Now, the initial leadership for this push to get a new government came from Virginia. In an event that's not put in many history books. In March 1785, a group of delegates from the Virginia House of Burgesses, which was like their state legislature, were invited to Washington's home, Mount Vernon. And there they would gather and they would hold a conference and they would basically start discussing things. But even more interesting, they invited delegates from Delaware. Because one of the big issues that Virginia and Delaware were dealing with was that interstate trade war. So basically they sat back and said, if the national government can't do anything about it, we'll see if we can fix it. They talked about tariffs. They talked about deregulating the shared waterways. They talked about pirates, problems of pirates, and so forth. Ultimately, one of the biggest concerns that what they had was they did not want to see a situation where the militia of Maryland would go to war with the militia of Virginia. So, they would hammer out an agreement. And most interestingly, they decided, well, Maryland is also having problems with Pennsylvania, so why don't we send them a copy and we'll get their take on things. Well, unfortunately, these were just guys sitting around coming up with proposals. They didn't have the authority to bind their governments to these agreements. But it was a first step. But the most important thing in their minutes, which were still preserved, was everyone in attendance agreed, we got to do this again, but let's just invite everybody. Maybe instead of dealing with interstate trade issues with two or three states, we could deal with all 13. Because if Congress can't fix the problems, maybe we, the state, should. Now, by the way, FYI, the problems that they were dealing with do exist today. The solution. Every single state in our country has passed what is known as the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC. UCC is a set of laws that deal with every aspect of commercial exchange. It didn't come from the national government. It came from the states, and it just so happens that every one of the states adopted the same code into their law. This is ultimately what the founding generation was trying to figure out, how to do the same thing. The national government can't do it, all the states will do the same. And you have uniformity. Questions? All right, would there be a gathering of the states? Yes, there would, the following year. September 1786, in Annapolis, delegates from 5 of the 13 states attended. And among the attendees were 2 or 3 men whose faces you may recognize. James Madison of Virginia, Alexander Hamilton of New York, Edmund Randolph of Virginia, first Attorney General of the United States, John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, all important founding fathers involved in the creation of the Constitution.
Were the other states not invited to join?
They were all invited.
Okay.
Several of them, particularly the New England states, attempted to get going,
but there was bad weather, and they were unable to arrive. And I think, let me think, who was there? It was New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Virginia. I think the Carolinas showed up late. Georgia did not attend.
I know that.
All right. So now here's the thing. This was an official meeting, unlike the Mount Vernon Conference. That was unofficial. This was official. All of the delegates that went from the states were selected by their state governments. So they had the power to negotiate, to try to hammer out a deal. But one of the amazing things is that the men that were there, all 12 of them, quickly realized, as they're talking about interstate commercial issues, they soon started talking about problems with the Confederation. They started saying, okay, if we do all this work and we come up with these proposals, the convention, the Congress, can basically shut us down. They could stop it from going into effect. Maybe we should make it so that way the national government could basically enforce these rules to kind of keep us on. They started talking. They started brainstorming. And apparently by the end they realized, not only do we need to do this again to get more people there, but maybe we should draft amendments. Maybe we should propose some actual amendments that go to the national government. They can vote on it, and they can change the Articles of Confederation. So as Caden said earlier, that would have to be unanimous. Well, in all of this, they made reports. They sent it not only to their own states, but they sent it to the other states, and they sent it to the national government. And apparently, people were like, meh. Some people argued, well, look how poor the showing was. Well, if only 5 out of the 13 showed up, maybe the most of the people in government don't want to change anything. Some basically said, well, if we do these amendments and give the national government more power, we're going to be weakening our states. Some were outright hostile. Particularly states like Virginia, who had such a strong economy, they not only managed to pay off all their debts, but they had profit by the end of the 1780s. Their government was on strong footing. They were expanding their commercial operations. They were winning the game. Why should we give up our success to loser states like Massachusetts? Arguments, disagreements, selfishness. Everything was circulating.
Until something big happened that caught everyone's attention.
And it happened here in this state. An actual rebellion against the government. And by the way, there were dozens of events like these throughout the nation, but Daniel Shea's rebellion was the most famous because it was the closest to success. Shea's, born in Hopkinton, served in the War of Independence, rallied a group of over 4,000 indebted, impoverished veterans and farmers who basically decided that their government was not representing them. Now, Shays, to say that he was a hero is an understatement. He was at Lexington and Concord. He was at Bunker Hill. He was at Saratoga. And in talking to his group that would gather, he simply put it, pointed out the fact. You men went to serve. You didn't get paid for your service. As a result, you owe bills to the government. Past taxes. Money on loans. And what does Beacon Hill do? Do they give you debt relief? Do they recognize your service to the country? No. They're working with the banks to push the foreclosures. How is that government representing us? So what did they do? They rebelled. They rebelled in Worcester, and they rebelled in Springfield. They took to the streets, and they essentially would shut down the cities. But in Springfield, there was a federal arsenal. A warehouse that had guns, had powder, had shot, and had cannon. So, this group basically marched on the arsenal with the intent of gathering artillery and essentially doing what happened in Massachusetts in 1774. When Henry Knox went to Fort Ticonderoga and dragged the guns all the way to lay siege to Boston. They were going to overthrow our government. Well, word went out from the state to the national government, send help. And the Congress said, well, there's nothing in the articles that say we can do anything to help you. Then the governor of Massachusetts asked Rhode Island, asked Connecticut, asked New Hampshire for help. And they're like, why? This has nothing to do with us. So in the end, the governor, whose name I cannot remember, and I apologize, who was one of the richest merchants under John Hancock, basically talked with a bunch of rich guys. They got a whole bunch of money, and they hired a mercenary army. Because they could not raise the local militias, because they figured the local militias would join with Shays. And ultimately, this private mercenary army began marching west from Boston. Caused the people in Worcester to scatter. And as they were getting near Springfield, Shays did attack the arsenal, but the soldiers that were there knew that this mercenary army was coming. So they fought like tooth and nail. Blood was shed. But in the end, the rebellion was scattered. But if it could happen in the birthplace of liberty, it could happen anywhere. And what happens if they actually won? Then what? This, ultimately, is what convinced the Congress to do something. Here's your analogy. When you're all old enough to own a house and you discover that there's a leak coming up in the attic because you got a bad old roof, when are you going to do something about it? Are you just going to let it sit there and hope it goes away?
No, you don't call somebody.
You gotta act quickly. They waited a little too long, but they finally moved. What did they do? They called for a convention to gather in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787. Did you put your hand up?
I was just wondering what the deal was with the, and if this doesn't fit, there's no problem, but the Whiskey Rebellion?
That's after. No, that's after the United States government was formed.
I was just going to ask about the Whiskey Rebellion.
And the Whiskey Rebellion, because Alexander Hamilton took one of Morris's ideas that were posed during the Articles of Confederacy,
which was to impose a national excise tax on whiskey. So once Hamilton got his way, the farmers out in western Pennsylvania, that was their revenue source, were like, no. And they rose up. But that didn't result in bloodshed. Other questions? Like I said, I know weird things. All right. So now, summer of 1787 rolls around, and delegates from 12 of the 13 states show up, and they decide, by the way, initially, they were charged with proposing amendments to improve the articles. But many who were there were basically like, your car has 375,000 miles on it. It has bad ball joints, bad springs. It's like bleeding oil. You turn it on, the radiator's leaking, the frame is rotted out, and you know, there's rust on every corner of the car. You gonna go and get an oil change? You're gonna do one thing to take care of that? No. They said, this is so much wrong, maybe we should just get rid of it all. By the way, this is known as the Constitutional Convention. Twelve states were there. Rhode Island decided not to show up. The reason being, Rhode Island was happy living in a country that had a weak national government that could not impose upon the rights of the citizens of Rhode Island. Of the 70 delegates that were invited, 55 attended. But here's an interesting FYI. Of the 55 who were there, only 39 put their name on the Constitution. 16 of the men that were there didn't like it. There were very famous men there, known throughout the land. Washington was there. Franklin was there. Madison, Hamilton, Edmund Randolph, Roger Sherman, James Wilson. But interestingly enough, many of the revolutionary heroes were not. Jefferson was not there. Neither of the Adams were there, John nor Sam. Patrick Henry was not there. John Hancock was not there.
For any particular reason?
Jefferson was the ambassador to France. John Adams was still the ambassador to England. Sam Adams was the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Patrick Henry, John Hancock didn't like the idea of changing anything. How about that? I've never been asked that. I always have that. I have that ready to go, but no one's ever asked that before. Here's another thing. It was not open to the public. It was behind closed doors. They actually had soldiers from the Pennsylvania militia surrounding the entire building. The shades were pulled. Now, keep in mind, have any of you been to Philadelphia during summertime?
Yeah.
It does get warm, and it's very, very humid. There was no air conditioning. And these guys were wearing woolen clothes.
I've actually been in that building, I think. Is it the same building?
Yeah. In fact, it does look just like it did, except for the central entranceway. But the meeting room, the green walls.
I didn't get to do the tour. I just got to look in and listen to the bell.
Yeah, gotcha.
It's all sold out. It's stupid.
Well, yeah, they only have so many slots to go through. Mm-hmm. All right, now, why do they keep it closed? Well, they wanted privacy because they wanted to be able to talk. Because let's be honest, this was politically huge.
and they didn't want to have people hold back. We as human beings are interesting creatures. We all have our opinions, but we're often afraid to share our opinions out of the fear of what other people were going to say. Well, these guys were going to roll up their sleeves and they were going to have at it. Nothing was to be left off the table. Every possible contingency was to be raised, debated, argued over, and discussed. The only actual account, because they kept no records either. There was no secretary. There was no recording secretary. By vote, they decided no. The only record that survived was Madison's notes. Madison, kind of like me, in that he thought better once he wrote everything down and he could look at it on paper. So he kept a fairly accurate record of what took place over the whole summer. But here's the interesting thing. Nobody knew that it existed until he was nearing his death. He ordered his family not to publish this until every last member of that convention was dead. He wanted it released posthumously. So it didn't end up getting published until 1840. We do know that Washington was selected to be the presiding officer. They did this because Washington was don't want to defame the founder and father of all of our country. But let's just say he was not a lawyer in that he didn't like arguing. He wasn't big for public debating. He was the kind of guy that just was comfortable just kind of sitting back and listening every now and then chiming in here and there. So because of his physical presence, he literally was the tallest man in the room at 6'4". The average height back then was about 5'7". So because of his record on the war, you know, being the general that saved the country, they figured he's the perfect guy to keep order because everyone in the room respected him. And then they went to work. Now, I have a copy of Madison's notes. I have it in, I think I have it in two books. Do I have two copies? I think I have two copies. But one of the interesting things that if you ever get your hands on it and you read is right out of the gates, nobody was on the same page. No pun intended. Everyone was divided over everything. So, some of the first things that were discussed. All right, under the Treaty of Paris, 1783, we got all the land from the Appalachian Mountains to the Mississippi. What do we do with it? Who should get it? Is that considered U.S. land? Or does it go to the states? And which states? You know, they didn't know. There was debate. There was disagreement. Do we increase the power of the national government? Or do we weaken the articles and empower the states? And on and on and on and on and on.
So was this so contentious that Madison didn't want to publish the documentation? Was he worried it was going to...
They all made a gentleman's agreement that no record was kept.
Got it.
He did at one point contemplate burning his notes. Mm-hmm. But Hamilton, John Jay, and some of the others just said, just keep it and keep it for yourself. Because again, imagine if, for instance, I'll just throw one hypothetical out there. So imagine you're from one of the small states, all right? But then suddenly you say that, yeah, we should have elections based upon population. Well, obviously, if you're a small state, that means you're never going to win anything.
you could be arguing against the interests of your own states. So you got to kind of keep that low. Now, ironically, speaking of small states representation, this was the biggest issue right out of the gates. And it got so contentious that several of the individual delegates left. Two guys from New York were like, this is ridiculous. We're out of here. If we're going to create a new government, we're not making a democracy. Democracy is mob rule. We are going to make a republic. But how do we determine how the people are represented? What type of entity should the representative sit in? Well, the first guy to put forward a proposal was Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin's proposal was pretty straightforward. He looked to the model that they had in Pennsylvania. They said there should be a unicameral legislature. One chamber. And the delegates should be sent by the state governments. So, in effect, the people have no say. Now, the funny thing is, his proposal was universally rejected. Because they said, Mr. Franklin, Dr. Franklin, that's exactly what we got under the Congress, under the Articles. The second proposal came from the Virginia delegation. Now, in this, Madison was, oh, you can't even read that. Oh, that's awful. Well, it's in your book anyways. I took the graph from your book. This was devised by James Madison while he was riding in the carriage going to Philadelphia. This plan, though, would be submitted by Edmund Randolph. Madison, his nickname was the Little Mouse.
And a very quiet, squeaking voice.
Whereas Edmund Randolph was like me, just loud and could project his voice. So Madison and Randolph worked together and allowed Randolph to present it to the convention. What is in the Virginia plan?
Most importantly, popular consent, which we talked about previously.
Under the Virginia plan, legitimacy would come from the people based on popular representation. In other words, the people vote and send the people, the representatives to Congress. And by the way, it is in your book in chapter 2. I know it's there. All of this information's there. Make sure you go over it. 2.
There would be a bicameral legislature. Two chambers, not just one, not a unicameral, bicameral.
There would be a House of Representatives and a Senate.
The House would be the people's house. So the people of the states would vote for men, delegates, now today women, who would go to the Capitol and serve. Direct election.
The Senate, the senators, would be selected by the House.
So the states would send a list of names. And ultimately, the election would take place in the House of Representatives.
Just to take a step back, the House of Representatives, directly elected by the people. The Senate, nominated by the states, selected by the House.
I'm sorry, what was selected by the House mean again?
So the people in the House of Representatives would get a list and they would be the ones deciding. Okay. So in other words, the people of the states would have no say.
Okay. Or to put it another way, the government would decide. Yep.
So one chamber would be elected by the people and yep. the other elected by the government.
Yes. Okay. Now here's the question. How many seats do the states get? Well, according to the Virginia plan, based on population and wealth.
Population and wealth.
So the big states would get more seats, and the smaller states would get less seats.
Why? Well,
if the big states have the most people, they should get the most seats. And the little states, they only get a few people, so they should only get a few.
Unlike under the Articles, there would be an executive branch. So it's not just this singular body, but rather you have a separation of powers.
The people in the executive branch, though, would be selected by the House and the Senate.
So the people would have no say who would be in the executive. The national government would pick.
They also could be removed by the Congress.
So, no say on who the national leader is going to be. No say from the people, no say from the states. Purely decided by the national government.
Now, because this was a rough draft, there are a couple of proposals on powers for the executive, but the most important one that was hugely significant, according to Madison, was the veto power. Because we got to have some type of checks and balances. The executive needs to stop the legislature from making laws that could be harmful.
How would the veto work? Didn't say.
All right, so we get this bicameral legislative body that's going to make the laws. We get this executive. And they didn't say how many people are going to be in the executive, what it was going to look like, just that there would be an executive. Well, what happens if a situation occurs under law? Well, Madison also said we need a third branch. We need a federal judiciary.
Courts. But here's the thing.
Under the proposal, the federal courts could nullify not only federal law, but could also nullify state laws.
So now the national government would have leverage over the states. But it would be in a court, so the states could go and make their case.
I know they're in your book, but I'll throw it out there. Any questions on anything I cover?
Yes?
Is that how the court system came to be today, like what you're talking about?
Kind of.
That's how it originated?
That's, well, for the federal courts. Because under the Articles, there was no judiciary. There were no federal courts. But Madison in particular, in his notes, basically laid out, look, we've had this trade war between Maryland and Virginia that could potentially lead to war. So if you have this neutral forum, a federal court, both sides could go and make their arguments, and then the court could make a decision.
Last point on the Virginia plan, and this was huge. What did they do in Massachusetts with our Constitution? How was it passed? Do you remember? I said. Do you remember?
Two-thirds vote?
No.
They said it must be approved by the people.
So this proposal was not going to go to the government under the Articles. It was not going to go to the state governments. But it should go directly to the people and let the people decide.
How it should be.
Absolutely. Well,
Virginia was like, yay! And Pennsylvania was like, yay! And Massachusetts was like, yay!
All of the big states were all excited. This is wonderful! Because obviously they would have the most control of government. But the small states, not so much. So while the Virginia plan dominated discussions for the first few weeks, lo and behold, when William Paterson of New Jersey showed up during the middle of the debate, he came up with another idea for representation. And this became known as the New Jersey plan. Now, Paterson did not disagree with the idea of the need to strengthen the national government. But he, like most of the delegates from the smaller states, were terrified of what the bigger states would do. They would just basically run rampant over everything. So the focus of his plan was basically trying to make a balance somehow between the big states and the little states that would prevent the big states from basically destroying the little. In comes the New Jersey plan. The biggest point about the New Jersey plan was that this would not be a new government. The focus of the New Jersey plan was the original mission of the convention. We're going to amend the articles. We're going to take what we have and fix it, not make something new. So what does this mean? You still got the unicameral government, one chamber. There is no federal executive. There is no federal judiciary. That's what we have under the Articles. So let's just keep that. Let's keep one vote per state. But let's give Congress power. Let's let them make tariffs. Let's let them regulate commerce. And let's give them the ability to keep the states in line. Give them authority over the states. He also proposed giving the national government the power to tax the states directly, based on population.
So how much taxes is Virginia going to pay? Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, New Hampshire? Well, it just depends on how many people you have in your state.
But you know what also Paterson threw in? The three-fifths clause into his tax proposal. What's the three-fifths clause?
Relating to slavery, right?
Exactly.
What was it?
Three-fifths clause.
No, what is it?
Every single slave, for tax purposes, is not going to count as a full person.
But rather, they're going to count as 3/5.
I don't think I've ever heard of that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, the argument was is that under the states that had slaves, which at this time was, I think, all of them except for Pennsylvania, the slaves were not treated as people. They were treated as property. So because they're property, it's not fair that they be taxed the same level as a free person. So we're going to give the states that have slaves, Massachusetts had slaves, by the way, during this time. We're going to give them a break. All right. Then he came back on day 3, after discussing, and added a couple of more interesting things. Because he fully came to grasp what was proposed under the Virginia plan. On day 3, he added, let's create a federal executive. Let's actually implement this separation of powers. But the executive will be a council. So we're not going to have a executive. We will have an executive board. Selected by Congress, serving a single term. Wait, that's what they have. That's what they had. But the problem was is it wasn't solidified. So now he wants to make it concrete.
The term was what, 4 years back then?
No, you would go and you would serve 1 year as the executive council out of every 3. So you could get reelected, but you only could do it every 3rd year. Also, he listened to Madison's argument about the need for a federal judiciary. And he basically decided, no, we don't need a whole court system, but rather there should be a supreme tribunal. So a court. And the job of that court would hear only arguments amongst the states. So now we have, to a degree, separation of powers. But the Supreme Tribunal, only interstate conflicts.
Two more things. He also threw in, because again, there was the recognition that the national government's got to be able to kind of keep states in line. He also added what became known as the Supremacy Clause. The Supremacy Clause. In which the articles and all federal treaties were to be viewed as the supreme law of the land. In other words, the states could not pass a law that went against federal law, or not federal, Confederate law.
And I got one more for you. He also proposed creating a national citizenship. Creating a national citizenship.
In other words, you would no longer be a citizen of Virginia or Rhode Island or Connecticut or Massachusetts as it was. Because quick side note, guess who used to control immigration law? Guess who used to determine citizenship? It wasn't the United States government, even under the Constitution. It was the states.
So Patterson came in and said, no, you know something? If you live in any of the states, you should be considered legally a United States citizen.
All right. They discussed all of Patterson's points, but on a whole, they voted against the plan. Now, FYI, they would take out the idea of the Supreme Tribunal. They would give his proposals powers to the Supreme Court of the United States. And they also would keep the Supremacy Clause, as well as the Three-Fifths Clause. So even though they rejected the plan as a whole, they did keep some of the ideas. So then they went back to the Virginia plan. But then a stalemate ensued. Because the little states basically said, look, fine, you don't like the New Jersey plan, but we don't like the Virginia plan. We're not going to go along with this. They were terrified that if the large states had full control over the government, they would begin basically erasing the states. That they would erase the state lines and would create a unified government, like exists in most of the world. And in doing so, the rights of the people of those states could then be trampled by this national government. The worst part is the big three, they all circled the wagons around this Virginia plan because that would allow them to control the country. And they refused to even listen to the concerns of the small states. So, how are we going to proceed? We've reached an impasse. Well, the guys that were there did something that few people actually have the ability to do. Let's take a step back and let's see if we can compromise. I'll give you a little if you give a little to me. A select committee was appointed. One delegate from each of the states. And they went out of the general gathering, sat behind closed doors, and would basically hammer out a compromise to determine this issue of representation once and for all. And it's commonly referred to either as the Connecticut Compromise, sometimes it's called the Great Compromise. This was the brainchild of Roger Sherman of Connecticut. Taking from the Virginia plan, there would be a bicameral legislature. Two chambers. There would be an upper chamber. That is the Senate. Then there would be the lower chamber. That would be the House of Representatives. The Senate would represent the states. The House would represent the people. In the Senate, all states, big or small, would get equal representation. How many? How many senators does each state have? Two. In the House, seats would be determined based on population. Today, 2025, what's the most populous state in the country? California, absolutely. Anybody know how many members of the House of Representatives they have?
Seven.
Oh, way more than seven. 51.
Whoa.
Now, by the way, there's only 435 members of Congress. So California gets 51. Second place is Texas. Third state, I think, is Florida.
Is it Florida or New York?
I think it's Florida. I could be wrong, though. I'll admit it if I'm wrong. All right. So, now we got this down. By the way, for representation, the slaves do count 3/5. 3/5. So in those states that have larger slave populations, by the way, coincidentally, the states that had the largest slave populations, like South Carolina, also had the smallest population of freedmen. So the idea was basically, let's give them a little more say, so that way they're not trampled by the northern states. How is this going to be a compromise? Well, what was the big charge that triggered the war for independence? No taxation without representation. So under the compromise, two chambers, Senate, upper chamber picked by the states, equal representation, lower chamber picked by the people. But anything dealing with money is going to come from the House of Representatives. So all revenue bills must start in the House. Lastly, because there's two, what happens if the Senate passes a bill that the states want, but maybe the people themselves don't want it? Will that bill become a law?
Not if it doesn't pass Congress.
Not if it doesn't pass Congress. So the final element of the Great Compromise, all bills must pass both chambers. Checks and balances. Now, by the way, this will be the last click because I'm not going to go over. In approving this, this was the states that had the biggest economies, the largest populations, giving up the power that they potentially had in controlling this country. But in the end, they decided compromise, even if they had to give up a little bit, was better than the Union dissolving, because that was the alternative. And as we're going to see when we come back, once they passed this, it was like breaking a hole in a dam. Once they got by this impasse, all other disputes were hammered out, and when we come back, we'll see all of the other compromises that were passed. All right, before I let you go, I got a couple of things. One, we're almost at the point when I'm ready to give you your first exam. We're going to finish the basic structure of the Constitution, and then we're going to cover the 10 amendments. If I can get through it all next class, you will have your exam. It's going to be remote. It's going to be through Ultra. So on one day of your choosing before I see you again. So it could be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. Or Monday, because Monday's a holiday, right? Yes. Well, guess what we'll have to do if it's, I've already showed you what I'm going to have to do. So they'll have to make you watch the video. So there's that. Two, I should have gotten it because I looked at the calendar. Topics were due last week. Topics for your paper. Totally forgot about it, but I want them this Friday. So figure out something that has to do with government and send me your topic. I don't need a thesis statement. I don't need like an extract. I just basically say, hey, professor, you know, I want to talk about the Second Amendment. I want to talk about taxing issues. I want to talk about a dispute between the state. You know, just give me a rough shot idea of what you want to talk about. But one thing to keep in mind when you pick your topics is that the paper itself is only going to end up being about 6 to 8 pages long. So if you think you're going to tell me a full discussion of every last aspect of Roe v. Wade, you're not going to be able to do it in 6 to 8 pages. So keep that in mind. You're just going to kind of do a general light review paper, but the topic has to be manageable, something that you can squeeze in that spot. Question?
Do we have to submit our topic somewhere?
Yeah, send me an email. Send me to either of my email addresses.
How's the exam like formatted?
It's wicked hard, no. It's going to be probably 30 to 35 multiple choice questions. I will give you two essays. One will count as an essay, and the other one will be extra credit.
Perfect.
And I usually make them so the average person can get it done in an hour.
All right.
All right, so topics. exam coming. We may be here on Wednesday. We may be digital. I don't know. It depends on what Mother Nature's going to throw at us.
Yeah.
And who came late?
I walked in late.
You are Roman.
Better. Yeah, I apologize.
You are? Ernest, yep. Anybody else?
I don't know if you have me on there.
Who are you? You're Zach. All right. He's out. Hold on. Let me just do this real quick.
One.
Yep, we'll see you. Well, that kid might have dropped. He hasn't been here since the first day. That's fine with me. Yes, sir.
Can I have the exact...